Right, good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yay, it's Friday, August 7th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, we made it. I always look forward to Fridays, like I said, even though there's not really anything different about Fridays, at least it means that I get 2 days off. And there's some awesome radio over the weekend here on UCY.TV. That I saw down in southern Texas, because I would not be too happy with that. So where did we leave off yesterday? Got some good stuff we're going to look at today. Yesterday we titled the show Propaganda, Scary Pictures, Soylent 2.0, and Bill Gates. One of the things that we looked at was vaccines. Brandon Turberville had done a story looking at how they push the vaccine agenda using propaganda and scary pictures. And we had also talked about scary music, and it works every single time. Oh no, somebody says that they have dead air. Well, someone better tell me whether or not we have dead air. Does everyone have dead air? Because I have a bad connection. Do 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 do. So does everyone have dead air, or is it just a few people? Because I don't have an equalizer. All right, they hear me. Anyway, so back looking at the vaccine propaganda, they use lots of scary pictures to then convince people to put their children up as sacrificial lambs for this newfangled technology, which we discovered is what? Oh, mostly financed by Department of Defense, at least in the angel financing. And then they spin off these small companies that then develop the vaccine, and then it goes into emergency trials in countries such as Africa that have quote unquote outbreaks. Well, here's a new one. We haven't seen this in a while. The second case of 2015 plague shows up in Colorado. Yes, we talked about one a few months ago. And I gotta tell you, on CNN, wait till I post this picture in the notes of the show, because talking about scary pictures, here the article is titled Adult Dies of Plague in Colorado, which is odd because there was a video pig mine put out early hours of this morning. It said it was a child, so I haven't really figured that one out yet. But in the CNN about the Ebola pictures of people bleeding out eyes in their mouths, well, now we have a plague victim with an arm. He's big, huge at the top of the page. All of his nails are black. His fingers are black. Yes, it looks like a black plague victim. Nothing like seeing black plague for breakfast. It says adult dies of plague in Colorado. Plague, a scourge of biblical proportions, with seven scary photos. The bacterium that is responsible for the plague can sometimes infect the blood, causing hands, feet, nose, and lips to become gangrenous and black. Oh, yeah, by the way, if you're eating breakfast, put your bagel down. This form of the disease is almost always fatal if not treated with antibiotics. I think we read there was pneumonic, bubonic, and then there was a third one. But yeah, it's like within the first few hours, you need to get yourself some antibiotics. I think it was the first 20, 24 hours or so. And yes, anyone who's having audio issues, it is me. I've been having technical difficulties for the last few days beyond normal. So I don't know. There's nothing I can do about it, but at least I'm here and I'm live. Anyway, centuries after ravaging millions, the plague has come to modern-day Colorado, leaving a devastated family behind after their loved ones succumbed to the disease. A Pueblo City County Health Department announcement Wednesday that an adult had died from the plague, a disease that has a long and sordid history, albeit not one typically associated with modern times or developed countries like the United States. And I thought the last plague case we had discovered they had caught from a dog, and the dog caught it. while he was out from fleas or a tick or something, and he had passed it along at the vet. The health department didn't detail who died. Beyond that, it was an adult. The agency said in a press release that, quote, the individual may have contracted the disease from fleas on a dead rodent or animal. It is the first such case of someone in Pueblo County contracting the plague since 2004. Quote, this highlights the importance to protect yourself and your pets from exposure of fleas that carry plague, said Sylvia Proud, the city county public health director. A dead prairie dog in the western part of Pueblo County is the only animal thus far confirmed to have had the plague in the immediate area. And here's the thing. Actually, the story that I saw this morning was at Yosemite Park, I believe, is where the other plague case came from. I don't know if I queued that video up or not, but it was Yosemite when I was just watching. But here's the thing. You know, if you remember when we looked again at the bioterror program, the historical biowarfare that happened in the United States up through 1972 officially, one of the big things that they had studied extensively was using insects such as fleas, ticks, and mosquitoes as disease vectors. So I still find it very interesting when we have these diseases that have disappeared for hundreds or if not even thousands of years, they've been gone, and well, look, they just out of the blue show up here in an infected prairie dog, especially in places like Colorado where we know that there's a lot of interesting federal agencies that have divisions located in the mountains of Colorado. Just strikes me as kind of an interesting coincidence. Ends up plagues also killed dozens in Madagascar. Anyway, the Center of Disease Control and Prevention found in a report released on April 30th, and this is one that we had talked about just a little bit ago, that a pit bull was at the heart of the plague outbreak that sickened four people last year. The report was especially significant, and then it suggested that there might have been, and yes, this was one of those interesting things, human-to-human transmission of the plague, and that has not happened in the United States since 1924. So, yes, again, never before seen, been 50, 70, 80 years, and holy shit, it's happened again, just out of the blue. The dog-to-human transmission was unexpected. According to Colorado's Tri-County Health Department, and the team that investigated the case said that they could only find one other case of dog-to-human transmission in the medical literature, and it was where? In China in 2009. How interesting is that? 2009 seems to be the year of diseases and vaccines, and it also was the year that the head of the CDC moved down to the head of the president of the vaccine division of Merck. The CDC said only about 7 people get the plague. Over 80% have been bubonic every year in the United States. And while it can be life-threatening with modern medicines such as, yes, antibiotics and antimicrobials, it is usually not deadly as it was in the Middle Ages. So, whew, be happy about that one. Make sure you don't get near little rodents, fleas, or ticks. You know, one way that I remember back a few years ago that someone caught the bubonic plague up at one of the Pacific Northwest National Parks was from fecal matter from rodents inside of a closed up cabin as well. So, I don't know, just pay attention. We got Ebola potentially in the homeland again. Mysteriously, of course, right as they're now going into phase 3 trials after they're saying they had 100% success rate with their new Ebola vaccine, launching it in Africa now to go after 13 to 17-year-olds and open it up to everybody. But now we may have another case of the bubonic plague in the homeland. So I think today we're going to continue on with the mad science gone mad and some of the crazy stuff that's happening and where this is planning on taking us. So we looked at the Soylent crap, the Soylent 2.0, which is this food replacement. And as we're watching these, of course, again, never before seen or out of control outbreaks such as bird flu, I had mentioned that swine virus where all the piglets were dying from having horrible diarrhea. Or who the hell knows what else? Massive drought that, of course, now we have to cull all these animals because there isn't enough crops to feed the animals. Lo and behold, in the last couple of years, we've gone from being abundant to being what? Oh, our food prices are going sky high. 90% of corn and soy in the United States produced is GMO. And that Soylent we discovered was made from soy and algae. So it doesn't say if it's GMO soy, but it doesn't say it's organic either, wink. We got rid of the labeling laws. We're pushing the dark act, so you don't need to know where your food comes from or what's in it. So don't worry about it. We got the UN in just about every single video that they put out over sustainable farming and sustainable protein. Almost every video is about how buck protein is so damn good for you. And it will be so much more sustainable than cattle protein. I just saw something the other day. They found a way now. I didn't seem to post it on my Before the First Cup page. I must have posted it on UCY, but I'll have to find that maybe for Monday. They found a way now to feed chemicals to cows to cut down on methane. And I was thinking to myself, well, didn't they already have that for people with Beano? Because I think they did. But hey, if they get rid of the methane that the cows produce, maybe beef will still be sustainable in the 21st century. But when all this is going on, I come across this story that really caught my attention. The Science Alert out of Australia, I get a lot of my stories from, but I really think they're on the other side because I can always see an agenda here that they're pushing. And don't forget, Australia is right in bed with everything that we do. They've been sucked into the New World Order faster than probably any other country. There's a story here titled, "What Would Happen If You Stopped Eating?" Well, what a good question. The subtitle is, "This is What Goes On Inside Your Body Without Food." We all know that food is essential to our survival. Well, good thing. And it also happens to taste great. Yes, unless, of course, there is no more food and you're forced to eat something like that disgusting Soylent. But what actually happens to your body if you stop eating? The latest episode of ASAP Science explains the day-to-day process of starvation, including why you get so damned hungry, what really happens in starvation mode, and most importantly, all the ways you can die from hunger. Now, can you say a little bit more of fear porn? Holy shit! So as this is all going on, and we have movies like The Hunger Games that are probably closer to reality than we know, here we go, putting out a dumb and user-friendly video explaining to the people with an 8-second attention span with pretty whiteboard-colored drawings, pretty pictures, what happens to you when you don't have food, why you should be scared, and why, when the food is finally gone, you're going to put out your open arms and accept the Soylent 2.0, accept the insect protein, accept the 3D printed nutrition that has no labeling, so you don't know what's in it or where it comes from, to play. So what if you stopped eating?
It's a pastime for many, which is convenient because we needed to live. But what would happen to you and your body if you were to completely stop eating now? In the first step, your body begins to break down glycogen, which stores energy in your body, into glucose, which your cells use as fuel. Around 25% of energy generated this way is used for your brain alone, while the rest goes to muscle tissue and red blood cells. But after about 6 hours, this method of energy production halts as the glycogen stores deplete, which can lead to the notorious hangry or hungry and angry feeling that many of us know too well. At this point, your body enters a state called ketosis as it begins to fast or starve. Because there's very little glucose in your blood, your body must begin to break down fat for energy. This fat is in turn broken down into fatty acids. However, your brain can't use long-chain fatty acids, which is a problem. Because there's no more glucose and the fat fats are too large to cross the blood-brain barrier, your brain changes modes and begins to use ketone bodies for energy, which are short-chain derivatives of fatty acids. This works for the time being, but ultimately only 75% of the brain's energy requirements can come from ketones. It still needs glucose, which means your cognitive functioning becomes impaired.
Which means your cognitive functioning becomes impaired. Wow, isn't that a state that they'd love to see us all in long term? So as food gets more expensive and people can't afford to eat anymore the way we used to have proper nutrition, people start cutting back on things, eating a little bit less, eating more unhealthy food because it's cheaper, of course. Notice how all the GMO foods are cheap and everyone can afford those. But if you try to eat organic, grain, grass-fed, non-GMO food, we'd all go broke. You can't eat it 24/7. And any of these newfangled, chemically induced foods aren't giving you any of the proper nutrition.
Now, it's important to mention that you don't have to be starving to be in ketosis. Many people enter this phase if they're on a low-carb diet, or professional athletes who use all their carbs for an extended period of time, like marathon runners, will be in this state as well. However, beyond 72 hours, not only will your mood and energy suffer, but your brain will start to break down your body's own protein.
Within 72 hours, the brain starts to break down, the body starts to break down its own proteins.
The proteins release amino acids, which can be converted into glucose, which is great news for your brain, but bad news for your body. Basically, your body is cannibalizing itself by destroying your muscle mass. In women, undernutrition often shuts down the menstrual cycle as the body tries to reduce energy expenditure. Bone density diminishes, and both men and women may experience loss of libido. Within a few weeks, the body's immune system will be so weakened without any vitamins or minerals that many will die from disease.
Oh, nice. Yes, we're so weakened at 1 to 2 weeks from a lack of vitamins and minerals that many will die. Now, what's so interesting about all of this is if we go back to some of the interviews that we heard with Dr. Huber, some of what happens with glyphosate is that it prevents the proper absorption of nutrients. And if we look at the colony collapse disorder that's going on with the bees, that's one of the things that he says that he absolutely believes is happening.
It will continue to use up all energy sources until there is no glucose, fat, tissue, or muscle mass left. One of the more common causes of death is cardiac arrhythmia or heart attack due to the tissue degradation in the heart, diaphragm, and body. This is fairly common in those suffering from anorexia. Of course, the body experiences severe organ failure all around. Starvation can lead to death in as short as 3 weeks or up to 70 days, as documented during the Irish hunger strikes in 1981. Though the duration of survival is greatly influenced by how hydrated you are and the amount of fat reserves your body has, which in some ways is incredible that the body can sustain for so long with no food.
Yeah.
And yet approximately 795 million people around the world have to deal with this reality. The good news is that the 7 richest countries have pledged to lift 500 million people out of hunger and malnutrition by 2030, but we need to hold them accountable. We're working with an organization called Global Citizen to do just that, and here's a really easy way that you can help out too. By
yes.
sharing this video and then heading to the Global Citizen website forum here, you'll be adding your voice to an important educational movement towards ending hunger worldwide.
And let's be good global citizens and go out there and end hunger worldwide. Like, how crazy is that? And don't forget, you die much quicker from lack of water than you do from lack of food. But that's a 1-2 punch because, hey, we're going into drought mode. Did you see California is like on fire everywhere? I'd love to talk to somebody in California to see how bad those wildfires are. So let's go back, though. I mentioned Dr. Huber and the bees. And they had just said that as you stop absorbing vitamins and minerals, there's a quick death. Well, hold on here because I actually, well, maybe not. I'm just having so many problems. Well, maybe, hold on, let's go to WN.com because they said that they have the video there. I'm not going to read it, though. Oh, too much reading this week. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe, maybe not. Proper absorption of nutrients, of course. Oh, here we go. Oh, and look at this. In this entire playlist that was searched with glyphosate, honeybees, and Dr. Huber, what else comes up? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 before the first cups as well. I've been noticing my before the first cups are coming up in playlist search engines in regards to glyphosate, GMOs. If you search immortality on the internet, you'll get me and Kurzweil, so it's pretty awesome. Here.
We've lost about 50% of the honeybee. There are three characteristics that you see with colony collapse disorder. You see a malnutrition of the bees, especially with micronutrient malnutrition.
Ding, ding.
You see a malnutrition in spite of having plenty of honey and bee bread and the resource in the hive, and yet the bees are malnourished.
So they have plenty of bee bread and honey, meaning they have plenty of food, but they're malnourished. Regardless of the fact that they have their food, that's exactly what glyphosate is doing to us as well.
And the third characteristic there is disorientation, and so that the bees leave the hive, they're malnourished, they're under stress, and then fail to return to the hive.
Yes, that's the mental confusion that they just said in the stages of starvation. That's one of the things that happens to us as well.
But if we look at all three of those characteristics of colony collapse disorder, we see that the most widely used herbicide in the world, probably the most abused herbicide or chemical that we've ever had in agriculture, glyphosate has an impact on all three of them. To start with, it's a very strong mineral chelator for essential minerals.
So there you go. It's a strong mineral chelator, and that's exactly what they said that we required, and it pulls the minerals out of your body.
In this case, the chelation that's done by Roundup or glyphosate, its active ingredient, it grabs onto important minerals, and it makes them unavailable for assimilation. So you may have copper, you may have selenium, you may have manganese in the system, but you can't use it.
All of those minerals that regulate our physiological processes that are critical for proper health and functioning and growth that are all reduced in availability for the bee. There's another factor that's involved from a health standpoint with the bee and also with digestion. Glyphosate is also a very potent antibiotic. Most of the beneficial organisms that we rely on and that the bee rely on, such as the lactobacillus and the bifidobacteria, are very sensitive to glyphosate. In the absence of those two bacteria in the honey crop or the bee stomach, the bee can't digest the food. It can.
So there you go. Glyphosate is also a very strong antibiotic, and it kills all of your beneficial gut bacteria in us, as well as the bees and the livestock. Hold on.
I have plenty of food there, and this is what we see with colony collapse disorder. You see plenty of honey, plenty of bee bread there, but they don't have the bacteria there so that they can digest it. So that they're essentially starving in the middle of food.
Bing, 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 bing. I mean, seriously, guys, the writing is so on the wall right now as to what is happening. And I really think that just some of these mental disorders that we see all over, this lack of mental capacity across the board with the American public, is coming from the lack of nutrition and the lack of proper absorption of nutrients because of the glyphosate in the food that we eat.
I know Falk did a study about 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, just putting a little glyphosate in the water for the bees, and had about a 34% mortality from them. So,
how much was put into the water?
They were the rates that were common for the area that she set this study up in.
That is amazing, because we know that glyphosate is in the air and the water. If she set up the amount of parts per million in relationship to what's there in an ambient basis, especially in the Midwest where they use all this stuff a lot, and there was a 34% death rate, then that's pretty, I mean, is that a smoking gun?
Glyphosate's in the air and the water, and we were just looking yesterday. It's also being found in human breast milk. How frightening is that? This stuff is pervasive everywhere in our environment, and how are we ever going to get rid of this poison? You know, it is causing us to die as human 1.0, but don't worry about it, because Soylent 2.0 is going to come out soon and cure us all.
Can you call that a smoking gun?
Well, certainly a red flag that why aren't we doing the research?
It's a smoking red flag. It's a smoking red flag. Okay, we'll go there. I was very interested in the fact that Monsanto purchased a company called Biologics.
Yes.
Where they were studying colony collapse disorder. And why would Monsanto take over this research company that might figure out what the cause of colony collapse disorder is? And now we're bringing in this new theory, which a lot of people believe, that colony collapse disorder comes from a nicotine-based insecticide that's used as a seed treatment. They're called neonicotinoids. And you end up basically creating a time-release system in the seeds that produce this insecticide for the first few weeks of the crop. And this is known to create disorientation of bees. They can't find their ways back to the hive. They've banned these neonicotinoids in certain countries in Europe. They're trying to ban them in the United States. So, Don, would the neonicotinoids, or could they explain colony collapse disorder completely? Or are there anything that's missing that we need to look at something else?
I want to stop here for a second. Yes, neonicotinoids are the pesticides that the majority of the scientific community are blaming the bee colony collapse disorder on. And Dr. Huber, who has over 50 years of experience, if you're not familiar with him, look him up and take a look at his history, where he's worked and what he does. He is definitely somebody to listen to. Dr. Huber's been involved from the federal government all the way down to university level, doing his own research on farm animals, foods, pesticides. The guy is very, very, very well researched, but he seems to believe, and he makes a pretty strong case, that glyphosate covers all of the bases as to what is killing the bees without neonicotinoids ever being involved.
Well, they don't explain why the bee isn't able to digest the honey and the bee bread and that's in the hive, why it's starving to death, or why it's micronutrient deficient. The only explanation that I know of, at least, that really fits the picture and in that whole area is the broad exposure, continuous exposure to glyphosate, so that it's not an acute toxin. But as other scientists have found, that it's probably the most chronically toxic compound that we've ever had in our environment.
There you go. And you know what? Hold on. It's going to start playing my show in the playlist. How awesome is that? I can't believe that my show's been showing up in connection with all these other people, but that's good. So one of the other things that glyphosate does as well that Dr. Huber talks about in another interview is not only does it kill all the beneficial bacteria in your gut and in the bee gut and in the animal gut, and not only does it show up in breast milk and cross the placental barrier for unborn fetuses, but also in the soil itself, it kills all the beneficial bacteria in the soil, leaving us with these dead zones where then toxic materials can take over. So anyway, we took a look at the story, Watch What Happens During Starvation. we listened to Dr. Huber talking about some of the reactions within humans and animals when they are exposed to glyphosate, a toxic pesticide. So I ran across the story yesterday out of phys.org, and the title caught my attention. Mutant cells that can't copy DNA somehow keep dividing when they shouldn't, with disastrous consequences. What? Yes, it looks like there's some freaky ass shit going on in nature now. Researchers at USC, and I'm assuming that that's the University of Southern California, have developed a yeast model to study a gene mutation that disrupts the duplication of DNA, causing massive damage to a cell's chromosome while somehow allowing the cell to continue to divide. The result is a mess. Zombie cells that by all rights should not be able to survive, let alone divide, with their chromosomes shattered and strung out between tiny micronuclei. Sometimes they're also connected to each other by ultra-fine DNA bridges, which would be like imagining tearing a hot pizza apart. These DNA bridges are like strings of cheese still draping between the separated pieces of pizza. Frequently, the micronuclei, which are thought to retain the most damaged portions of the DNA, rejoin the parent nuclei and incorporate mutations into these survivors. The mutation has been associated with cancer in mice, and micronuclei are also often found in human cancer cells. Ding, ding. And with their new yeast model, researchers hope to learn more about each. Quote, using a simple yeast system, we have developed a powerful genetic model to investigate a recently identified characteristic of human cancer cells, says Susan Forsberg, senior author of the article about the research that will appear online ahead of the print version of the journal Molecular Biology of the Cell on August 5th. This will enable us to rapidly identify genes responsible for this abnormal division. Since the genes that regulate division in human and yeast cells are what? Oh, they're the same. Yes, they are the same. This simple organism provides a tool for human cell discovery, and I'm going to add this to this, it also provides a tool to figure out how to use this dangerous mutation for their benefit. This is a pretty scary thing. This can cause our DNA to go completely AWOL and then become zombie cells and reproduce like crazy. DNA is vulnerable to damage when it is unzipped into two single strands for replication by a cell's MCM helicase, which is a cellular component essential to DNA replication. Typically, the single-stranded DNA triggers repair of damage by special enzymes, or in extreme cases, drives the damaged cell to suicide. Either way, mitosis, which is a fancy word for cell division, is halted while the issue is dealt with. But in cancer cells, despite the damaged DNA, the cells continue to divide, creating tumors full of genetic mutations. In this study, a mutation in the yeast MCM helicase triggered responses similar to those in mammals, where mutations in this gene are associated with cancer and the formation of micronuclei, which is that cheesy pull the pizza apart stuff. To study the phenomenon, Forsberg and lead author Sarah Sabatino collected videos of damaged cells dividing so they could maintain continuous monitoring of individual cells and record cell division from beginning to end. They watched what would happen in the mutants in real time. And then they used a super resolution microscope that generates 3D images of objects at a nanometer scale to examine the damaged structures in crisp detail. Quote, The devil is in the division. In real time, we are able to see that these mutant cells ignore the damage caused by DNA replication, which results in the creation of unusual structures like micronuclei. Their work will inform future studies into how a cancer cell evades biological checkpoints that should halt its division and its spread. Now, guys, we've talked so many times about how the future is going to be surveilling us at a cellular level. Of course, they have all kinds of little nanotechnology robot doctors that they're talking about putting in your bloodstream to be able to surveil you 24/7 and make sure that you're not coming down with any unbeknownst diseases. But on the flip side, being able to study things at such a micro nano level also gives them the secrets to life and how they can destroy life. So isn't this an interesting little story about how this mutation in DNA causes this zombie replication that completely destroys the DNA in cells, and hey, guess what? Can take out human 1.0, and it's the exact same cells in yeast as there are in humans. I mean, how ethical is this to not only be messing around with this, but what if somebody lets that genie out of the bottle, those things escape, and somehow infect people? Well, listen to this. Don't worry about it. Phys.org. Biochemical sensor implanted at initial biopsy could allow doctors to better monitor and adjust cancer treatments. In the battle against cancer, which kills nearly 8 million people worldwide each year, doctors have in their arsenal many powerful weapons, including chemotherapy and radiation. But what they do lack, however, is good reconnaissance, a reliable way to obtain what? Yes, real-time data about how well a particular therapy is working in any given patient. Magnetic resonance imaging and other scanning technologies can indicate the size of a tumor, while the most detailed information about how well a treatment is working comes from pathologists' examination of tissue taken in biopsies. And that is true. Yet these methods only offer a snapshot of tumor response, and the invasive nature of biopsies makes them risky. So now, MIT's Cook Institute, oh yes, for integrative cancer research, are oh man, I'm talking on mute. How long has it been? All right, I better go back here. So did I get to the biochemical sensors? Sorry guys, I have my notebook here, so I must have hit the mute button. All right, I guess I'll read the story again. Biochemical sensors implanted at initial biopsy could allow doctors to better monitor and adjust cancer treatment. Sorry guys. In the battle against cancer, which kills nearly 8 million people worldwide, doctors have in their arsenal many powerful weapons, including various forms of chemotherapy and radiation. But hey, what they lack is good reconnaissance and a reliable way to obtain real-time data about how well a particular therapy is working for any given patient. MRIs and other scanning technologies can indicate the size of a tumor, while most detailed information about how well a treatment is working comes from pathologist examination of tissue taken in biopsies, yet these methods only offer a snapshot of tumor response. Now researchers at MIT's Cook Institute for Integrative Cancer Research are closing in on that information gap by developing a tiny biochemical sensor that what can be implanted in cancerous tissue during initial biopsy. The sensor then wirelessly sends data about these telltale markers to an external reader device, allowing doctors to better monitor a patient's progress and adjust dosages and switch therapies accordingly. How wonderful is that? You know, they really have been pushing biomedical sensors for quite a while. It says the sensor housing, made of biocompatible plastic, is small enough to fit in the tip of a biopsy needle. Guys, remember, as electronics get smaller and smaller, and we've listened to the father of nanotechnology, Eric Drexler, talking about the exponential ability to make things smaller and smaller and smaller. So we have these full-blown nano factories to build things from the molecular structure on up. This isn't fantasy anymore. All right, I don't know. I read part of that story on mute. There really wasn't much more that I wanted to read about that, except that it came from MIT. It's going to be due, of course, Watch Cancer, so it'll make the desperate step right up and let them implant it and be part of the guinea pig trial for them to see how well little sensors work within the body and see whether or not your body rejects it. But hey, you got cancer, so you're going to step right up anyway. Here's another one. On printing pills, FDA approves drugs made using a what? 3D printer. Yes. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved some new pills. Nothing new there, it would seem, except that these tablets were 3D printed. The makers hope that the technology can be used more widely in the field of medicine. Aprecia, A-P-R-E-C-I-A, is the pharmaceutical company behind the new drug called Spritam, S-P-R-I-T-A-M. The firm is also the distinction of printing the first product that has been approved by the FDA for use inside of the human body. These pills are being used to treat epilepsy in adults and children, and the tablet's unique structure makes them dissolve much quicker than other drugs on the market, which sufferers say are difficult to swallow. These new drugs are expected to be released in early 2016. The tablet is made by 3D printing layers of a powdered drug and then binding the powder together. The makers of the pills say that their technology will also allow doctors and pharmacists to know the exact dosage being administered. Well, that would be very important for them now, wouldn't it? Although this is the first time 3D printed pills have been given the go-ahead, the printing technique has already been widely used by medical transplants. And yes, we've been seeing them 3D printing organs for quite a while now. All right, I'm going to bounce to another story. This is Friday. I have so much to catch up on. It doesn't look like we're going to make it to all of it. But hey, at least we'll make it to most of it. Chemical treatment transforms skin cells into what? Neurons. Yes, now when we look at this entire brain project that's being sponsored by universities and governments across the globe, this is quite significant, including DARPA, Google, all the big boys are in the middle of this brain project and trying to figure out all the secrets that go into the brain, building AI and supercomputers that mimic the brain. Well, hey, simple skin cells can now be turned into neurons. Two teams of researchers have found different ways to perform the same biological identity swap. Hey, isn't identity swapping something that looks like it's been going on for quite a while? Right, we have the whole identity crisis as to what sex you are. Well, now our cells don't know what they're supposed to be either. Turning skin cells into neurons. both approaches, which involve merely adding a few chemicals to the cells, could lead to new ways to treat a person's disease using cells from their own body, yes, or for destroying, again, human 1.0. There's always a double-edged sword to technology. That's what gets me. People look at this as that it's going to save us. That's the way we always sell the research. It's going to save the human race. But if some evil mother got their hands on this technology, it could also be a massive bioweapon that could take out all of biology. I don't know, if all of our cells start flipping and turning into other cells? Could you imagine? Be the Isle of Dr. Moreau on steroids. Turn into big blobby masses of Jabba the Hutt. Most of the ways scientists turn one type of cell into another or into more basic stem cells depends on adding genes to the original cells. Oh, you mean like what they're doing with nanotechnology and some of the new vaccine research? Yes, just like that. But this gene insertion approach also has its drawbacks. Its intricate steps are time-consuming, and there is always a chance that adding genes could land somewhere on a chromosome that activates something like what? Oh, a cancer-causing gene. Yes, but don't worry about it, because now we have these tiny little sensors that provide us real-time data that we can implant into your tumor cell. So don't worry about it. We got it all the bases covered. The new approaches, both published online today in Stem Cell, takes a less invasive route. The key explains Gang Pei, a biochemist at the Shanghai Institute for Biological Sciences in China and a co-author on one of the studies. Our so-called small molecule chemicals that can slip into a cell, entering the DNA-containing nucleus, and then alter the activity of the gene. Now, wait. I think we need to read that sentence again, because that's a pretty scary thought. The key, explains Gang Pei, our so-called small molecule chemicals that can slip into a cell, enter the DNA-containing nucleus, and alter the activity of a gene. Pei and his team probed thousands of chemicals to identify those that could convert one type of cell into another and found a specific recipe of molecules that essentially switched off skin cell genes in humans and turned on neuron genes. When the group added seven small molecules denoted as VCRFSGY, and then they give all the names for these, which I'm not going to read because it would be comical, to a petri dish of human skin cells, the cells transformed into mature, functional neurons over a course of a few weeks. Now, how scary is this, thinking about lunatics like Kurzweil, where they literally could take human skin cells, which our entire body are covered with a big organ called skin, and turn all the skin cells into neurons. This is making me think of things such as X-Men. This is insanely scary, and hey, guess what? It's happening in China. In a second study, another group of researchers based out of China accomplished the same task in mouse cells using a different chemical cocktail. The fact that two different chemical combinations are able to transform skin cells into neurons suggests this technique can be complete with gene insertions for cellular reprogramming. Molecular and cell biologists say the technique could become an important player in personalized medicine. Ding, ding.
specifically in using a patient's own cells to develop therapies for their disease or even provide a source of transplantable cells for treatment. Indeed, Pei's team showed that skin cells from an Alzheimer's patient could be coaxed into neurons that expressed several telltale markers of Alzheimer's disease. These results lay the groundwork for future Alzheimer's research. Of course, it's going to be to cure disease, not to mutate life on the planet. These results lay the groundwork for future Alzheimer's research, giving scientists a safe and accurate platform to test the effect of possible new drugs. Guys, I mean, this is the exact same correlation between our biowarfare program that quote-unquote no longer exists, but we're going to go into a defensive posture and create vaccines to defend against it. Well, hey, we have now this genetics program worldwide, mad science gone mad, no ethics or morals anywhere. We're all doing it under the guise of making you healthy and curing your disease. But you can absolutely see how some of this lunacy, if it were let out of the bottle, it got into our food chain, it became infectious, it was somehow mixed with some sort of easily transmissible common cold virus that then became airborne. This literally could become some insane, like, genetic bioterror weapon. It's horrifying. It is absolutely horrifying. Last paragraph here. These cell-transforming collections of small molecules could really help transform medicine as well, says Jenny Heesch, a molecular biologist at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, who was not involved in either study. She says, quote, "We are just scratching the surface here." Yes, we most certainly are. And talking about scratching the surface, hold on, if I can get here, I'm using the mouse with the left hand. Immortality is one step closer. And remember, this is the dangling carrot that lunatics such as Kurzweil and all the other rich fuckers are going after. Immortality is one step closer as scientists turn off the aging process in worms. They did. We will one day be able to disable the aging process. Does it sound like an impossible goal? But scientists at Northwestern University in the U.S. have found a way to turn off the genetic switch, which causes us to get older, in worms at least. While it won't give us the keys to immortality just yet, the discovery could lead to new ways of making us more productive and more active in the later years of our lives. According to the study, this genetic switch is automatically flipped when a worm reaches reproductive maturity. Stress responses that originally protect the cells by keeping vital proteins folded and functional are switched off at this point, and the aging process begins in earnest. But with the switch disabled, the cells keep up their earlier level of resistance, making the worm better able to handle the wear and tear of growing older. So, hey, let's just flip off some more genetic switches and see what happens. Maybe we can live forever, Kurzweil. At least until they figure out how to transplant our brains into the machine. Here's one more story, and this one was from quite a few years ago, but wow, this makes you wonder. They did a reprint of this in the Smithsonian, January 22nd, 2015. Young blood rejuvenates older tissues. Experiments in surgically joined animals that share blood have inspired anti-aging hopes. The word parabiosis doesn't seem so strange. Paro means beside and bios means life. But in some of the scientific fields, it means something fascinating and occasionally creepy. In parapsychology, physiology, parabiosis means the two living creatures are joined together. Conjoined twins have spontaneous parabiosis, but it can also refer to something more unsettling when researchers surgically join two animals together. They do this for study, for example, to watch the effects of hormones as they flow through artificially wetted circulatory systems. 150 years of such studies. So they've been doing this for 150 years, attaching two animals together to let their blood and chemicals flow between each other to see what happens. 150 years of such studies have helped advance our understanding of endocrinology, immunology, and oncology. And when two animals, one young and one old, are joined together, they can reveal surprising things about aging. Now, I'll tell you all those stories about the elites preying on young creatures to live forever. I always call bullshit until I read the story. This is from Nature Magazine, quote, by joining the circulatory systems of an old mouse to that of a young mouse, scientists have produced some remarkable results. In the heart, brain, muscle, and almost every other tissue examined, the blood of young mice seems to bring new life to aging organs, making older mice strong, smarter, and healthier. And it even makes their fur shinier. Now, these labs have begun to identify the components of young blood that are responsible for these changes. Guys, lock up your children and keep them safe. This is absolutely insane, says one of the researchers involved in such work, who, Tony Weiss-Core, hey, remember the Weiss Institute, W-I-S-S? Tony Weiss-Core of Stanford University says, we are restarting the aging clock. All right, guys, and I think that's about it because we are at the end of the show. Have an awesome weekend. Make sure you guys stick around. There's all kinds of radio today, tonight. Lonnie Clark is live up next. We have all new shows this weekend. And I will be back on Monday. I don't hear any music, so hopefully there is some. But if there isn't, then make sure you stick around. I don't know what's going on. Technical issues upside down and sideways. All right, I guess I'll read a little more until the music starts. Amy.